It's time for America Outdoors Radio, the show that covers the outdoor scene across the U.S. of A. and the entire continent. Fishing, hunting, conservation, outdoor recreation, and great destinations, we cover it all every week. It's your country, your outdoors. Let's explore it together with your host, John Cruz.
Coronavirus just isn't fading away like many of us hoped it would this summer. In fact, it's surging throughout much of the country, and masking mandates are unfortunately back in many places, to include our national parks. Earlier this week, the National Park Service announced you now have to wear a mask inside all National Park Service buildings, on transportation vehicles like buses or boats, and even in crowded outdoor spaces, whether you are vaccinated or not. They didn't define what a crowded outdoor space is, but I'm guessing the crowd watching Old Faithful in Yellowstone, that would probably count, as would ranger-led programs in the parks. On the other hand, I would imagine if you're hiking a backcountry trail or fishing a trout stream, you're probably okay to take that mask off. In brighter news, dove hunting season is right around the corner, kicking off either September 1st or the first Saturday of September, that being the 4th this year, in many states around our country. I generally am out for the opener, but I've got to tell you, mourning dove populations have gone down significantly in my home state of Washington, and I suspect other states are suffering as well. The reason? The Eurasian collared dove. It's a much bigger dove than the mourning dove, and it just outcompetes them for food and nesting sites. Eurasian collared doves are an invasive species, and their numbers have exploded, not just in the Pacific Northwest, but in states all over the nation. It's become a real problem, and in a lot of places in America, you can hunt them year-round with no limit, but the problem is they tend to hang out in towns or suburban areas where you can't legally discharge a firearm to take them out. I am curious, if you're a dove hunter, are you seeing the same problem that I am when it comes to the whole mourning dove versus Eurasian collared dove equation? Send me an email and let me know. Again, I am just really curious about this. You can do so through our website at AmericaOutdoorsRadio.com. Now, where you can shoot Eurasian collared doves legally, I've got the perfect tool for you to use. That would be a 410 shotgun from Henry Repeating Arms. You can either buy a lever action shotgun, though you'll want to make sure it's legal to use that for bird hunting, or you can use a single shot 410, which would work just perfect for those big doves. Like all firearms from Henry Repeating Arms, they are made in America. They are accurate, they're reliable, and oh yes, they're rugged. And if you want to find out more about not just 410 shotguns, but just great rifles for plinking and for hunting, most of them lever action, go to henryusa.com. That's the website for Henry Repeating Arms, henryusa.com. And while you're there, don't forget to ask for your free catalog and decals too. This week on America Outdoors Radio, we'll be talking about another bird hunting season opening up the 1st of September in several western and plain states. That bird would be the sharp-tailed grouse, and the man who's going to tell you about hunting them is Scott Linden, that well-known upland bird hunting television host, author, and former host of both Field and Stream and Outdoor Life Radio. Following that, we've got the opportunity to chat with Dr. Frank Roer. He's the president and chief scientist for Delta Waterfowl. In addition to telling you about this great organization, Dr. Roer will also share the fall duck and goose hunting forecast with you, and I can tell you, it's definitely a mixed bag this year. This show's not just about the birds, we've got elk to talk about too, especially since bow hunting season for them is kicking off soon. Jace Bozerman is the author of a great article you can read right now at OutdoorLife.com about practicing with that bow of yours before the season starts. Jace specifically has three drills for you to do that will definitely help you harvest an elk this season. And these same tips, well, they'll come in very handy for deer hunters too. You won't want to miss this. Next on America Outdoors Radio, in case you didn't know it, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is celebrating its 150th birthday this year, and they have published a new book about the organization and what it's done. It's called America's Bountiful Waters. It's published by Stackpole Books. With us here today is the editor of this fine book, Craig Springer, with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Craig, great to have you on the air.
Hey, John. Thanks for the invite. I appreciate it.
Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit more about America's Bountiful Waters? What's inside this hardcover book?
Well, America's Bountiful Waters is a commemoration of 150 years of fisheries conservation in the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We started as a U.S. Fish Commission, operated from 1871 to 1903. Then we became the U.S. Bureau of Fisheries and was the U.S. Bureau of Fisheries until 1940, when the Bureau of Fisheries and Biological Survey joined to become the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And in this book is stories about fish, some plants, some toads, blind salamander. It's mostly about fish that we work with, and these stories are written by the people that know them best. So history, cultural history, biography, and in some cases, memoir.
All right. Well, you wrote some of these stories yourself, and it always fascinates me, our fisheries here in America. Some of our fish, obviously, are native fish. Others are introduced. You wrote a piece about the smallmouth bass. Why don't you tell us about its history here in America?
Yeah, sure. So I had an early encounter with smallmouth bass as a boy in southwest Ohio. I used to fish a stream called Four Mile Creek, and the fish made a big impression on me and ultimately led to, a master's degree researching smallmouth bass at an introduced population in Arizona. And the research I did, I got in the water with the fish at various times a day and studied how they selected habitat during the day, in the middle of the night, and at dusk and dawn. And it was like peering behind the curtain, seeing how nature works. It was fascinating work. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has worked with smallmouth bass for a very long time. We've cultured them in our hatcheries, and we've done habitat work to make habitat better for the fish. The better the habitat, the more habitat you have, the better the fishing. Smallmouth bass was, just as a side note, one of the first fishes that traveled by airplane. They weren't stocked by air, which we have done, but they traveled from Northville, Michigan to Dayton, Ohio, about 1923, I think it was.
I'll be darned. The smallmouth bass, is this a fish that is native to America, or was it introduced? And if it is native, where did it originate from? Because obviously you can find it in almost all of our states now, it seems.
Yeah, smallmouth bass is naturally occurring, native only to the upper Mississippi Basin from southern Canada to, I guess approximately northern Arkansas, and then from west of the Appalachians to the Great Plains. It's been introduced on the Atlantic seaboard, some really good smallmouth bass populations in like the Shenandoah River, St. Lawrence Seaway, places like that. And they've been introduced in cool water reservoirs in the central U.S. and in the west.
Yes, and they are prolific in the Pacific Northwest, especially in the Columbia River. Now, this book mostly is about fish, but there are some species that are not fish. The Texas blind salamander. Never heard of the critter. Tell our listeners more.
So, the Texas blind salamander occurs naturally in watery caves in central Texas, and it is blind. It has no eyes. As a young organism, they have these little vestiges of optic nerves, but they eventually go away. There's no eyes, and they're kind of a ghostly white. They have no pigmentation because they never see sunlight. And they were discovered by Barton Everman, who we have a story about in the book. Barton Everman may be better known to your folks as discovering golden trout, but he was working on establishing a fish culture station, a national fish hatchery near San Marcos, Texas, and they sunk wells, doing test wells. This is like 1890, 95, something like that, and these blind salamanders just kind of popped up. But now they are an imperiled species, and we have them at our San Marcos Aquatic Resource Center in San Marcos, Texas, and we're working to propagate them and conserve them, hold them in refugia should anything happen bad to them in the wild.
Great stuff here. And folks, there's so much more in here, too. Again, a lot about fish, but as you just heard, there's also stories about people involved in conservation and fisheries here in the United States over the last 150 years, and about critters like the Texas blind salamander and other amphibians and animals and reptiles, too. Again, the book is America's Bountiful Waters. It's published by Stackpole Books. The editor is Craig Springer, and you can find it wherever you find books, whether it be Amazon or bookstores, or at the Stackpole Books website. Craig, congratulations on putting this together, and thanks for sharing this with us today on America Outdoors Radio.
Thank you, John. Thanks for having me on.
Hmm. Backcountry Hunters and Anglers is the voice for your public lands, waters, and wildlife. From the Canadian Yukon to the Florida Everglades, we're stepping up to conserve North America's public lands, defend our hunting and fishing traditions, and expand public access to the outdoors. Our outdoor heritage depends on sportsmen and women like you speaking up for the natural resources that sustain our way of life. Find out how you can get involved at backcountryhunters.org and become a BHA member today.
The Dalzen, Oregon is your base camp for fishing fun. Reel in big salmon, tangle with steelhead, bass, and walleye, or wrestle a monster sturgeon to the boat. After the day is done, you'll find a variety of lodging options around town. Need to resupply? We've got you covered with sporting goods stores plus great dining, breweries, wineries, and can't-miss attractions like the Gorge Discovery Center. Plan your fishing getaway today at explorethedalles.com. That's explorethedalles.com.
Are you looking to reel in the marketing opportunity of a lifetime? Then set the hook, because we've got it right here for you. America Outdoors Radio has sponsorships available, and we offer affordable platforms to reach thousands of listeners interested in fishing, hunting, and the outdoors. Find out more by contacting John Cruz through his website at AmericaOutdoorsRadio.com. That's AmericaOutdoorsRadio.com. Hurry, though. If you wait too long, the big opportunity might get away.
Why book at Sportsman's Cove Lodge?
Why is Alaska like no other place on Earth? It hasn't changed in thousands of years.
From the way you get here on a float plane to the way you go out with the guides and the boats, it's just a professional experience.
And I said, this is as good as it gets. I said, if you can't catch fish here, you can't catch fish anywhere.
Your experience with us will leave you speechless.
Book now at AlaskasBestLodge.com.
Welcome back to America Outdoors Radio. I'm John Cruz. September 1st is coming up quick, and that means sharp-tailed grouse season is going to be opening up in several western states. And what better person to talk to about chasing grouse than Scott Linden, the man behind Scott Linden Upland Nation, and also person I consider my mentor. He's the former host of Field Stream and Outdoor Life Radio. Scott, great to have you back on the air.
Don't hold that against me.
Well, let's just say I've been a big fan for a long time, and I'm thrilled to be following your footsteps, but you're more in the TV world now, and you love to chase after upland birds. That is what trips your trigger, and I know you love chasing after sharp-tailed grouse. What states have you hunted them in, and generally, what is the season for these birds?
Well, you hit on the first part already. September 1st is almost always the opening day for sharptails and doves in many states and ruffed grouse in many states, or forest grouse in many states. So that's pretty safe, except Idaho, where the season starts October 1 and ends on Halloween. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 states that usually have a season. And then there's a few that sometimes have a season, and that's not counting some of the prairie provinces in Canada where you're in an entirely different universe. There's so many birds up there. But I've hunted both North Dakota and South Dakota. I've hunted Wyoming, and I've hunted Nebraska for these birds, and Montana, but not Alaska and not Idaho yet, and certainly not Minnesota, Michigan, Colorado, and Wisconsin. So not bad, and I like to think those are some of the best states for that stuff. And, you know, we talk about a season that opens on September 1st and in many cases runs for months and months and months. But the bottom line is, if you're not chasing sharptails in the first few weeks of the season, then you're just out for a nice long walk. The birds have been pestered by other hunters. They've coveyed up into big groups that have lookouts at every point on the compass, and seldom will you get close enough to take a shot.
Interesting. What is your favorite state to hunt sharpies? I mean, if somebody says, Scott, where should I go? And they're looking for lots of birds and lots of public access, where would you send them?
Lots of birds is a relative term. You know, you're walking 4 to 15 miles in a day. So bear that in mind. And the problem with that is that time of year, it's hot. So you want to be careful about your dog. I don't care about you, but I care about your dog. But in terms of where I would go, either the Dakotas has good access and good numbers. Montana has incredible numbers and pretty good access. And the sleeper state is Nebraska. Everybody's heard of the Sand Hills. Well, let me tell you, if I die and go to heaven, there better be grass-covered hills of sand there, because that's where I want to be.
Well, I hope to see you there, Scott. But in the meantime, for people who have not done sharp-tailed grouse hunting before, why don't you tell people what the terrain's like? Because it's not the same as, you know, when you're sizing up a place to go pheasant hunting, it's obvious what it is. Same thing with chukar, same thing with quail. But the terrain that the sharp-tailed grouse lives in, it's much more subtle, isn't it?
For the most part, yes. But interestingly, there are times of year and times of day when they act like all those other birds. For the most part, as one biologist said to me, the first thing you want to look for is grass that is tall enough that it bends in the wind. So shin, knee-high grass. Any shorter than that, and it might be Hungarian partridge country, but the Sharpies like that slightly taller grass. Depending on where you're going, it's rolling hills or relatively flat prairie. But just like a lot of birds, and I love this part of it, and the Little Missouri grasslands in North Dakota is a perfect example, but it's everywhere. If there's cracks and crevices, folds and wrinkles in the terrain, and in those wrinkles and folds, there's snowberry bushes or a water course or some kind of cover, even, you know, low timber stands and things like that. Sometimes that's where you'll find the birds.
Interesting.
Especially in higher wind or in hotter temperatures. These birds are birds. They're shade-loving birds. And so early in the season, quite often, what you're really looking for is shade.
Great advice. Got a question for you. I have had grouse before in terms of rough grouse or forest grouse. I have spruce grouse, which I regret, but I've never had sharp-tailed grouse. How are they as table fare, and how do you like to cook them?
Well, you know, they're different in that they fly hard and they fly often, so their breast meat is relatively red, much like, you know, some of the other hard-flying birds. And the first thing I suggest is, you know, the usual stuff. Cool them out as quickly as you can. I will take all the meat and I'll soak it overnight in salt water, and that'll leach out any of the, you know, the blood and the bloodshot. So that's the first thing you do. After that, the meat is maybe a little bit more wild tasting than some birds, but it takes well to any kind of seasoning that you're going to put on it. And, you know, a lot of people will say, oh, I'll just throw it all in the crock pot with a can of cream of mushroom soup.
Right.
And there's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, if you want to cook it low and slow, then, yeah, you better be real moist as well. But the other way to cook it is hot and fast and just too rare, because when you pull it off the grill, it's going to continue to cook a little bit. And not as bad as the waterfowl, but, you know, all upland birds will taste a little funny and get a little bit tougher if you cook them beyond medium rare. So be careful about that. I've had it cooked in any number of ways, and then you can do all the usual stuff with it. You can pull all the meat off and make a pot pie or a taco out of it. Those are some of my favorites. But, you know, anything you do with any other bird is going to be fine as long as you've kept care of it from the beginning.
Great advice as always. Last question that you need to answer for our listeners. What's going on with the Scott Linden Upland Nation, and how can they get involved with it?
Oh, I'd love that. First off, the third printing of my book, What the Dogs Taught Me, is coming out with a new title and in paperback for the first time in October, so watch for that. Apparently, they can't find anybody else who wants to write about the topic, so they're going to reprint my book again. And you can just Google my name at Amazon, and you'll find it there. In fact, you can pre-order it now, for that matter. You know, I was born a teacher. My mother was a teacher, so I got the DNA, and I'm back to doing a lot of teaching in video form. So go to my YouTube channel and learn how to take care of your dog in the field, how to feed it right, how to, you know, do first aid on it, and then how to shoot better, and particularly, and this may be the next book, how to access public land more productively. Seems to be a red hot topic. And you know, I've been doing it for a long time. I've hunted in 26 states across the U.S., and most of it not at Orvis-endorsed lodges. So I'm trying to teach other people how to do that in a lot of those videos. So go to the Scott Linden Outdoors YouTube channel and learn some things there. And that's a good way to start.
All right, Scott. Thank you so much for the time, as always. I know you're a busy man. Good luck hunting this season, and I can't wait to get you on the air again.
Looking forward to it, John. Have a great fall.
Hunting and fishing are exercises in hope. Before you head into the woods, you hope to tag out on a deer you'll have to field dress. Before you make that first cast, you hope for a big fish to clean and fillet. When your hopes are realized, you'll need a sharp knife. Whether you sharpen that blade on a power sharpener in the shop or a manual sharpener in the field, WorkSharp has the tool for you. Look for WorkSharp products in sporting goods stores near you or online at WorkSharpTools.com.
This is the time of year to get out and cook out. So make your next meal sizzle with Camp Chef, the brand known for quality outdoor cooking. From camp stove to cast iron, from smokers to grills, Camp Chef will change the way you cook outdoors. To eat like a king on your next adventure, go to campchef.com or visit your local sporting goods store and get cooking. Whether you're serving breakfast in the backcountry or barbecue on the back patio, savor the simplicity with Camp Chef. Camp Chef, the way to cook outdoors.
Pheasants Forever is working hard every day to ensure there's more wildlife habitat for the future. Join the habitat leader and help create wildlife habitat in your community. Go to pheasantsforever.org.
You're back in with America Outdoors Radio. I'm John Cruz, and duck and goose hunting season, it is right around the corner. That's why we've got Dr. Frank Rower on the line. He's the president and chief scientist for Delta Waterfowl, and he's going to break down the fall flight forecast for ducks and also how the goose hunting season is looking too. Dr. Rower, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, happy to be here, John. Thanks.
Let's start off with the fall flight forecast for ducks. I know the western U.S. has seen a drought like I haven't seen in a couple of decades. That can't be good, can it?
Oh, it really can't. I did a trip to Klamath this year, and it was just depressing how little water they have at that, you know, fabulous site, working in Northern California as well, and it was just bone dry. So I would say the Pacific Flyway got the worst of it this year. It's going to be really tough for ducks produced in the lower 48 just because it's so dry. Intermountain marshes in Nevada and Utah, many of them are dry. So we're not going to get much production except what comes out of Canada, northern Canada, and Alaska. Of course, Alaska is pretty stable, so that's the only bright spot I could speak to.
Let's talk about the Prairie Potholes region. How are the Dakotas looking?
Yeah, the Dakotas are bad. Now, let me also point out that we haven't done the May surveys where we count ducks and wetlands. When I say we, the waterfowl community, they've been canceled 2 years in a row because of COVID. And so what you're getting are my impressions from having traveled a lot in Prairie Canada and in the Dakotas for sure. And it's bad. It's worse than I've seen it since, the late 80s, early 90s, when we were in that prolonged drought. And what makes it odd this year is it's dry everywhere. So last year, North Dakota had a lot of water. And then, boy, the spigot shut off. And it was dry last summer, so the wetlands dried up. And then we got no snow in the winter. So the Dakotas are bad. And Prairie Canada's bad. Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Alberta are all in poorer condition. So duck production in the Prairie Pothole region, that famous area that produces 70 to 50% of the ducks we shoot typically, it's going to be real, real poor this year.
I'm starting to suffer from some depression here. Let's head further east. Give me some better news out of the Mississippi Flyway or the Atlantic.
Let me go backwards and say, you know, this is the first year of a really bad drought that's across the prairie. So we still have high duck numbers. So that was, that's the good news out of the prairies. We won't get great production, but we have good duck numbers. When we go east, things are better. This was a better year in the eastern provinces, Ontario and Quebec and the northeastern U.S. So it's wetter over there than it has been, and that'll be good production for the Atlantic flyway. So
that's good. Thank you for at least giving us that.
A glimmer of hope. That's right.
All right. So if you're east of the Mississippi, you're probably in for a good duck season. If you are west of the Mississippi, there are the existing ducks that, were born before
that's
the
right.
drought, but production-wise, yep. really rough because yep. of the drought. Let's turn to geese. Canada geese, or I should say the Canada goose, their population has just exploded over the last couple of decades. Have they been affected in the same way by this drought, or can we expect some good goose hunting this year?
Not at all. And the Canada geese that you're mostly talking about are the big Canadas, the giant Canadas that breed sort of in the southern region. And amazingly enough, in North Dakota, the big Canadas did great again this year. So, we've been looking at year over year sort of 8-10% growth, which is ridiculously, high growth rate. So big Canadas have done really well, and Arctic geese have done mostly pretty well. Now, again, this is based my assessment now. I obviously haven't been to the Arctic, and moreover, the Canadian Wildlife Service guys haven't been to the Arctic. So they're looking at climate data. But climate data drives Arctic goose production, and we didn't have a really late year this year. We had a very normal year, and so it looks like we'll have good production of snow geese and Ross's geese. And even the Canada geese that are doing fairly poorly, like those Atlantic flyway Canadas, it looks like the weather data said that they would have an okay year. We won't know until the fall, but things look way better for geese. So it'll be a good year to be a goose hunter.
There you go. All right. Good year to be a goose hunter. Maybe not so much for a duck hunter, especially if you're west of the Mississippi. Let's talk about Delta Waterfowl. It used to be, when I was growing up, the organization that you kind of tied yourself with when it came to the waterfowling community and conservation was Ducks Unlimited. Delta Waterfowl has really grown in prominence over the last 10 years or so. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit more about your organization and how it differs from Ducks Unlimited?
Yeah, you're exactly right, John. I'm an old guy, and I was a Ducks Unlimited member way back in the 70s when I first started hunting, or the late 60s. And I never even heard of Delta Waterfowl until the mid-70s, when I lucked into finding out about this tiny organization. We've been around since 1911, believe it or not.
Wow.
But we had been very, very quiet for the first, let's say, 80 years. And we only developed a membership, for instance, in recent decades. So there was no membership. We were a tiny research-only organization. And that's how I learned about Delta. And we've grown dramatically, and so now we have a quite a large membership. We're not Ducks Unlimited size, but large membership. We have our roots in science, so we were always a science-based organization, but now we've delved out, gotten much larger, and so we're doing active management. And so, the two recipes for more ducks, our goal is to produce more ducks and to help duck hunters. To produce more ducks, it's very simple. You go to the prairies or the breeding grounds, and you protect habitat, and then you try and enhance duck production, enhance hatch. Those predators eat most duck eggs. So.
Right.
So that's what Delta does.
Interesting. I always used to think of Delta Waterfowl as the southern organization that was east of the Mississippi, but you've got chapters in the Pacific Northwest, and your headquarters is actually in North Dakota now, in Bismarck.
Yeah. We get support from guys in the south, but by and large, if you look at Delta, we focus on the breeding grounds. Every scrap of information about ducks says that what drives duck populations is what happens on the breeding grounds. There's no limitation of winter habitat. So we completely focus, or 99% of our focus, I should say, is on the breeding grounds, and particularly on that prairie pothole region, best duck production area in North America. So that's where we've been located. We started as an advocacy organization way back, in 1911 back east, but we quickly moved to Manitoba, where we had our research station. And since then, we've expanded and do research everywhere. But our research focus is still about duck production on the prairies.
I understand you're a science-based organization, an advocate for waterfowl and for duck hunting as well. Do you do work that's similar to like the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation in terms of purchasing habitat for ducks, or are you doing different kinds of work?
To be honest, we don't advocate much for purchase just because it's such a daunting task. If you're focused on the prairies, you've got a huge area, much larger than the size of Texas. That's the prairie pothole region. And so just think about it. You can't buy Texas. That's hopeless. So that's not our goal. We do a lot of habitat work, but our habitat work is almost all focused on policy work that makes good farm policy and good duck policy. So we have a policy guy, John Devney, works in D.C. all the time, works very closely with the Ducks Unlimited policy folks, I should point out, working on things like how do you get more CRP? You know, there's a huge thing for ducks. And, you know, we're trying to increase the acreage of CRP to create grass for nesting cover. How do you protect wetlands and make sure that we keep our wetlands intact in the Dakotas? So that's our habitat focus. And then we spend our management dollars on duck production stuff. So that's one of the ways we differ from Ducks Unlimited.
Okay. Well, thanks for breaking that down for us. Unfortunately, we're out of time. But folks, if you want to learn more about Delta Waterfowl and get some state-by-state forecasts, the website to go to is deltawaterfowl.org. That's deltawaterfowl.org. This is a great organization that's doing great things for ducks and duck hunters and our habitat as well. Check out that website again, deltawaterfowl.org. Dr. Rower, thank you so much for your time today on America Outdoors Radio.
Thanks, John. Enjoyed it.
This portion of the show was brought to you by our friends at WorkSharp. They're the fine folks out of Ashland, Oregon, who make knife and tool sharpeners that you can use whether you're hunting or fishing or camping or maybe in your shop, maybe in your kitchen, for all of the knives and tools you need sharpened every day when you work and play. WorkSharp tools can be found online at WorkSharpTools.com or you can find them in sporting goods stores and hardware stores all over our great nation. Just look for WorkSharp products to sharpen your knives and your tools, because nothing is worse than trying to get the job done right with a dull blade.
We love our children. We protect them. We guide them. We prepare them for life in the world. With all that we do, from deep in our hearts, we cannot control all things. Life-threatening illnesses and disabilities affect far too many of our children each year. While we cannot change the circumstance, we can make dreams come true. Dreams to provide hope, to provide spiritual healing and strength, to provide moments of happiness and relief in the hardest of times. We can give a glimmer of light and hope in a time of darkness and despair. Join huntofalifetime.org to help make dreams come true, to provide hope for children with life-threatening illnesses and disabilities. Hunt of a Lifetime is a nonprofit organization fulfilling dreams for hunting and fishing trips to youth 21 and under with life-threatening illnesses and disabilities. Visit huntofalifetime.org to learn how you can make a difference.
Why book at Sportsman's Cove Lodge?
Why is Alaska like no other place on Earth? It hasn't changed in thousands of years.
From the way you get here on a float plane to the way you go out with the guides and the boats, it's just a professional experience.
And I said, this is as good as it gets. I said, if you can't catch fish here, you can't catch fish anywhere.
Your experience with us will leave you speechless.
Book now at alaskasbestlodge.com.
Hey, how'd the meeting go with Tommy's school counselor today?
Well, not exactly as planned. I think we need help.
Help? Why do we need help?
Well, I asked her about paying for college, and she said that's not something they do.
Maybe it is time to get some help. Even if Tommy just goes to state college, it's going to cost at least $25,000 a year. We'll have to raid our retirement and pay for Tommy's tuition. There's got to be a better way.
There is a better way. A way where you can pay less for college, or even receive college tuition free, regardless of your income or your students' grades. A way for you to keep your hard-earned income and savings for your future and spend less on college, while virtually eliminating the need for student loans. Get the facts about college admissions and tuition by going to tuitionprograms.org. That's tuitionprograms.org. tuitionprograms.org. Get the facts about college admissions and tuition by going to tuitionprograms.org.
You're back in with America Outdoors Radio. I'm John Cruz. Our next stop is the Centennial State of Colorado. That's where we get to talk to Chase Boserman. He is a bow hunting expert, and he just wrote a great article in Outdoor Life, and you can read it at outdoorlife.com, that's got three wonderful bow hunting tips that'll make you a better hunter for elk this fall. Chase, welcome to the show.
Hey, man, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, I'm thrilled to have you on. This is just really good stuff. It's a short, compact article with a lot to fit in. We've got a few minutes to talk about it. Let's go through your first tip. Why is it important when you're practicing for the season ahead to learn to hold to exhaustion?
Well, the main reason behind that is because when you're out pounding foam on the range and stuff like that, you know, you've got time and you can take the shot whenever you need to, whenever you let the release fire the bow, those sorts of things. But in a hunting situation, especially with elk, it's not uncommon to find yourself at full draw for a very long period of time. Whether that bull sixth sense catches in and he notices a little bit of your draw cycle, or they just have an uncanny ability to hang up for 20 seconds, 15 seconds, 30 seconds behind a tree limb or that one spot you need that arrow to go through. So you need to build up your muscle stamina and be able to hold at full draw. And this does two things. One, it improves your stamina as a bow hunter. The more you do it, the more you practice it. If you do it a couple times a week, you're going to get where you can hold for longer periods of time. And the second thing it does is it really helps fight off target panic. It helps you trust your pin float, because after about 30, 40 seconds on target, that pin looks like it's bobbing and weaving all over the place. But the thing to remember is, even though you're experiencing that float and that exhaustion, your subconscious mind is constantly dragging that pin back and forth across the spot you want that arrow to impact. So you just learn to trust it and continue to go through your shot cycle until you're able to get that arrow off.
Good stuff there. Next thing you recommend folks practice is you need to shoot at angles. And this makes perfect sense, because I think most of us who shoot a bow, we've got a target in the backyard and we are shooting, well, it's flat. It's just flat. And that's not the way it usually works when you're out hunting.
That's really true, especially when you're out hunting the West. You know, I was on a Rocky Mountain Bighorn sheep hunt. I drew my once in a lifetime sheep hunt earlier this August, and I killed a ram at 64 and a half yards. That was the true ballistic range for my arrow. Line of sight was more like 81, 82 yards. And so, you know, oftentimes in the elk woods or mule deer or whatever you're hunting out west, shots are not had on flat ground. So you need to be able to go out, take a target, you know, get into some hilly terrain and practice both up and downhill shots. You need to make sure you're bending at the waist, making sure your anchor remains consistent, the same anchor that you have when you're shooting on flat ground. This is also going to show you if your third axis is correct, because when shooting at angles, that's the only purpose of the third axis on your bow, is it's going to make sure your bubble is not lying to you when you're shooting at angles. And you need to make sure that that third axis is set correctly. There's lots of different ways, depending on the site you have, to set third axis correctly. And if you don't know, you should visit your local pro shop. Make sure you get that axis set correctly, but don't just say, okay, it's good and it's set correctly. Go out and prove it. There's no better way to build confidence and make sure that axis is set correctly than shooting at extreme and downhill angles and taking those shots and getting in a groove, so that when that moment of truth arrives in the woods and you have to shoot at a downward or upward angle, you're able to make that shot proficiently.
You're listening to America Outdoors Radio. We're talking to Chase Boserman, who wrote a great article for Outdoor Life about practicing and some tips that'll make you a better elk hunter this fall. Final tip you've got in this great article, find the ideal shot window. Why don't you explain what that means?
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, again, it all goes back to what we experience on the home range, right, in our backyard or on the shooting range. And that is, you know, our target's wide open. We don't have any obstructions between us and the target, those sorts of things. When you're calling in elk, you know, it's not always going to be a perfect shot window. You might have to shoot over some brush or shoot over a tree limb or under a tree limb, different things like that. And the only way to really practice and know at what ranges your arrow can clear based on where your pin is to get out in the woods and set up some 3D targets, set them in locations where you're going to have to do some of those things. And it might cost you some carbon. I mean, you might even break a piece of carbon, things like that. But the knowledge you're going to gain from going out and setting up 3D targets in these different windows and executing these shots from your knees, standing, flat on your butt, those sorts of things, that's going to make you a more proficient bow hunter. And it's going to give you the knowledge you need when that bull comes in to know that, hey, yeah, if I hold my pin here, I'm going to clear that limb. I'm going to get it right in his lungs, and we're going to be celebrating here before too long. So it's very important to get out and do that. 3D shoots are great for this. Often, though, you'll find that in a 3D shoot, you know, it's not, you might have to pick a narrow lane to get an arrow through, which is also great, but you really want to practice being able to shoot clearance and find out if that arrow can go over or under, those types of things.
Absolutely epic advice to get ready for elk season. And folks, if you're a deer hunter, all these tips apply to you as well. So get out the bow and go through these tips and start practicing now. And if you want a review, go to OutdoorLife.com. Look for Jace Boserman's article, Bow Hunting Tips That Will Make You a Better Hunter This Elk Hunting Season. Jace, thanks for sharing your expertise with us today on America Outdoors Radio.
Thank you.
In other news out of Minnesota, the State Department of Natural Resources is asking hunters not to shoot the bears they've got radio collars on for research purposes, which makes sense because it takes quite a bit of effort to capture, tranquilize, and radio collar a bear, and once it's dead, well, that research is over. So, how do you know if that bear in your sights is radio collared? Because sometimes the fur grows over the collar. Well, in Minnesota, it's all about the big, flashy earrings those bears wear. The 20 research bears that have been collared each have a brightly colored 2x3-inch tag in one of their ears. As for what kind of research the DNR is doing with these bears, Andy Tree, a bear research scientist with Minnesota DNR, says they are looking at year-to-year changes in natural food supplies and how that affects individual bears in terms of their habitat use, physical condition, denning, reproduction, and interactions with people. Tree says this research is not designed to evaluate mortality from hunting, and these collared bears give the agency a lot of data that they use in bear management, and it's really valuable when those bears are around for multiple years so they can go ahead and get better data and better patterning. This all makes sense. So, as a hunter, do your part and give those black bears with the big gaudy earrings a pass this hunting season. Heading to Tennessee, we mentioned dove hunting at the beginning of the show, and if you're a landowner in the Volunteer State with a grain field, you've got the opportunity to make some money in September. The Tennessee Wildlife Resources Agency is actively seeking fields to lease for the upcoming dove season that opens September 1st. Landowners can earn up to $3,600 for providing a dove field for public hunting. These fields must be available for a minimum of 3 priority hunt dates in September. TWRA began this lease dove field program in the late 80s, and it's been really successful in providing quality hunting opportunities for hunters. The standard fall leased field is a harvested grain field to which the state agency leases the hunting rights for 3 dates. The hunting access rate paid to the landowners for fall leased fields may be up to $75 an acre for a maximum of 40 acres. If you are a landowner interested in leasing a dove field to the state, contact your TWRA regional office this month. And we've got good news for anglers in Idaho, where some 25,000 fall Chinook and 14,000 coho salmon are forecast to return to rivers within the state. Salmon fishing is now open on portions of the Clearwater, Snake, and Salmon rivers for Chinook salmon, and on September 1st, it opens up for the Silvers. From personal experience, I can tell you the fishing can be pretty darn good from now all the way through September for these fish. The daily limit on Chinook salmon is 3 adults per day, with no limits on the jacks under 24 inches long. As for the coho, you can keep 2 of those a day, and there's no limit on the jacks for this species either. Now, you may be thinking to yourself what you're going to use to catch these salmon. A lot of folks will be side-drifting eggs from boats. That's a very effective technique, but casting spinners or spoons from shore works too, and one spoon I've used to catch both salmon and steelhead is the Daredevil Devil Dog Spoon. Lucky for you, we are giving 6 of these spoons away, along with some great swag from Daredevil Lures, and we're doing so at the end of our last broadcast this weekend. If you want to get in on this giveaway, here's what you do. Go to our Facebook page at America Outdoors Radio. Just like and follow the page. That's step one. Then look for the post thread where we've got the giveaway, and just tell us what state you're from. That's all you have to do. If you want a bonus entry, though, let us know what station you're tuning into our show on, too. Like I said, we'll pick one winner at the end of our broadcast, contact you through Facebook, and get this lure package headed your way. Just a reminder, if you didn't catch this whole show, you can catch it as a podcast in a few days. Just look for America Outdoors Radio or America Outdoors Radio Podcast on your favorite digital platform to listen to what you missed or maybe listen again to what you just heard on the air. Until next time, here's hoping you are blessed and here's hoping you get outside for some fishing, some hunting, and other fun. After all, it is your country and your outdoors, so get out there and enjoy it.